Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
Was a bug, little bug, hardly there. How he felt, what he dreamed, who would care? Without any evidence,
his scars were many.
He was full of confidence. Have much common sense.
It's highly overrated.
He just knew that he'd come through. It's the time of your life, so live it well. It's the time of your life, so live it well.
See, that should have been the theme music to Three Body Problem. It's actually the theme music to, or the opening song to, A Bug's Life, but it just would have worked so well. Why am I the only person who saw that? We're going to talk today about, not about A Bug's Life, we're going to talk about a three-body problem, the beginning, probably, of what I would guess will be a three-season adaptation of a series of Chinese science fiction novels. We'll tell you a lot more about that. A little bit later on the show, we're going to talk about a new comedy special by Rami Youssef. But let me introduce our panel today. Rebecca Castellani is co-founder of Quiet Corner Communications and a freelance writer, and her Castomatic nanofiber egg slicer makes Cobb salads a snap and cleans up with a hose. Sean Murray is a stand-up comedian, writer, the host of the Nobody Asked Sean podcast, and the man who keeps telling the Santee if they take the Sawmill River Parkway, they can get here in 390 years. Bill Usman is professor of media studies at Sacred Heart University. He's joining us from the Popular Culture Association National Conference in Chicago, where he was part of a panel earlier this week on communication and digital culture. His presentation was called Postman, Jones, Rogan, Brand, and Musk, Disinforming Ourselves to Death. I would actually like to, quite seriously, like to see that presentation or read a transcript or something. But he's taking time out to do our show, and he's also not reneging on his volunteer gig of reading European fairy tales to advanced alien civilizations through a 1940s radio console. So they're all here. They're all ready. They're all ready to talk about Three-Body Problem. Let's give you a little taste of this. Let's hear a little clip from the first episode. This is Eliza Gonzalez as Augie Salazar, Jess Hong as Jin Cheng. They are two members of the Oxford Five, so to speak. I remember when Pete Best was the drummer for the Oxford Five. But there's sort of five characters who are, you know, youngish people who are Oxford graduates and very, you know, high up the ladder in the various kinds of physics and applied physics and stuff like that, except for one guy who I think is just like teaching high school or something. Anyway, I'll shut up. Here's a cut from A1.
Okay, why is everyone freaking out?
About a month ago, all the major accelerators started generating results that make no sense.
It's been a while since particle physics, but this can't.
Nope, it can't.
Oh, then maybe it's a hack.
In every accelerator on the planet. I went through the CERN code line by line. Nothing.
The code? For the centralized software? How many lines is that?
It's a lot, Augie. It's a lot of f***ing lines.
Okay, so it's a hardware issue.
Dipole magnets, muon chambers, calorimeters, every component checked four times over in every collider from here to Beijing.
Okay, so what is Saul saying?
He says it's impossible.
What about you?
These experiments teach us how the universe works. And that, that's Alice in Wonderland.
Okay, I'm not sure how much that clip would tell you about anything, but our panelists can tell you about anything. I should say that two of our panelists have read the books, or at least one of the books. One of our panelists has read all three of the books. We're going to have a fourth panelist, is Barack Obama, who's also read the books, and his Zoom is not working. So I don't know what we're going to do about that. But it's on Netflix. It's adapted by Benioff and Weiss, along with Alexander Wu. Benioff and Weiss, of course, are the people who adapted Game of Thrones for television. So, Rebecca, I think, read the first of the books. So Bill and I are... relatively innocent. I mean, we're just coming to this as an 8-episode Netflix series. For you and Sean, it's a little bit more complicated. You've got ideas about the books and how they're making it to the screen. But just say a little bit about how you're feeling about that right now.
Yeah, so I read the first book a few years ago. I actually think I endorsed it on the show. And it was really kind of unlike any science fiction I've read before. And I do love me some science fiction. And it was just immersive in a way that you can't get out of. Once you're in it, that's all you're going to do until you finish it. And it broke my brain, so much so that I haven't attempted to read the second and third books, though after watching half the series, I'm tempted to finish reading them before I finish the series, so I don't incur any spoilers, because I'm kind of up to the point in the series where the first book ends. But I really, really loved it. It stayed with me. I've thought about it deeply since. It's very scientific, very historical. It's grounded in the Cultural Revolution, and it's obviously a Chinese book, so it's very much from the Chinese perspective, which the Netflix series has made more of like a global perspective, which I think was a smart choice, though there's been some backlash around that. But it really is one of those books that just kind of comes up in my mind like fairly frequently. And when I heard that it was being turned into a television show, I was incredibly nervous because it seemed absolutely unadaptable to me. Part of the conceit of the first book is a video game. And I was like, gosh, this is going to be like a Ready Player One misstep where it's just, it doesn't translate. And I was really nervous. And then I heard that Weiss and Benioff were doing it. And I've certainly said this on the show before. They have destroyed all my trust with the way they butchered the end of Game of Thrones. So at that point, I was pretty incensed that they were going to ruin another book that I love. But I was pleasantly surprised by how good this series is. I think it's really made some good improvements on the source texts. They've changed some characters a little bit. They've expanded sort of the central character in the first book into three characters, which is kind of smart because he was sort of an underbaked character in the book. Actually, I'd say there's the biggest criticism I have of the book is that some of the characters feel a little flat. And I think seeing them as fully realized people and in the hands of some really superb actors really helped that. So on the whole, very pleasantly surprised. I'm still ready for Weiss and Benioff to disappoint me. They've probably got another season to do that, but so far so good.
You know, on the watch, Chris Ryan and Andy Greenwald made an interesting point, Rebecca, which is that, you know, the Benioff and Weiss didn't screw up Game of Thrones until they got ahead of George R.R. Martin's books, and they weren't adapting anymore. They were making and kind of adapting at the same time. So we might be safe here, you know. I mean, they're probably not going to get ahead of this source material. But, you know, Sean, you know, Rebecca said that it's been made less specifically Chinese and more global. I'd almost say it's damn near BritBox at this point. I mean, it's global, yeah. But this is also, it feels like this kind of, you know, it's like the British version of Friends, except that they're all physicists and, you know, we're going to die. But Sean, I'd love your thoughts, wherever you want to take this.
Well, first of all, Colin, I would like to say, just apologize to you and your listeners, because I was going to come in here with a bit about how I didn't like the show because it was unrealistic, and then only to later reveal that I was doing that because I'm one of the Santee's representative on Earth.
We knew that.
But I just didn't flesh it out enough. So
the Shanti.
Oh, wow. Bill.
See, sorry.
I would have had that ready to go. But I didn't like it for other reasons that even fewer would laugh at. I thought it's not bad. But my issue with it is it really highlights to me like the freedom that you have in a novel where it's like you're not constrained by like your CGI budget or how well this actor portrays, you know, this expression or like how good it looks when there's a countdown in front of somebody's eyes, which I thought looked kind of silly. But I do think it works. I think it really works when it really gets into, strangely enough, I think it works the best when it gets into the deep science stuff that I thought would be a little bit too, like that's one of the reasons that people call this series so unadaptable is because, like, it, I mean, the first book is pretty like Rebecca says, like, it broke her brain. If you get to book two and three, it just gets so, it's unbelievably abstract into, like, the scientific concepts. Oh, it's God. Like, but it's so interesting. Like, you don't actually, like, I think it's pronounced Cixin Liu has such a grasp of the science that you don't have to have a grasp of the science. Like, there's a scene in, I think it's episode two or three, where I forgot the character's name, but she's at dinner with her partner's family, and she's explaining, like, how from one dimension, I mean, looking at like a tortilla or whatever, or like mm-hmm. it was naan, I think, and you know, it looks like two dimensions, but then it's actually three dimensions, and there's infinite dimensions within that. Like, there's a part of book two or maybe book three that like explores that on a much larger scale, and it's one of the most fascinating things I've ever read. Hmm. But anyway, my point is, I hate the Oxford Five. I hate, like, I think they're the most boring part of the entire series. Like, they're not interesting. It's very, like, that's the most, like, typical, like, British TV series feeling of the show, where it's like, I don't care anything what they're doing. Once they put the helmet on and they're inside the game, I'm all for it. Even sometimes the CGI is not great, but that's not, you know, the fault necessarily of the show. It's just like, you know, all right, I know I'm rambling here. Just one last point. The thing with Dune, right? Dune is another book that people have called Unadaptable Forever. And yeah. I think the reason that it was, has been such a success is because even though it doesn't, it's not a one-to-one adaptation in terms of like some of the concepts and visuals and of the book, but Denis Villeneuve has such a singular vision about how he wanted to create this that like it's very meticulous in how he creates it. Whereas with something like this, I don't feel like there's that strong a vision like behind the camera to like make it all work perfectly. But again, I think the science stuff, all the stuff with the video game, all the stuff with like figuring out the three-body problem and all that stuff and like the ETO organization is really good.
All right. Well, that's all we have time for, but good show. And you know what? I like the fact that Sean, who's very young, is already kind of an old man yelling at clouds. it's happening so fast.
I'm not gonna lie, I looked at my watch when you said that. I was like, is it really that long? Jeez.
Is it yelling at clouds or yelling at the clouds?
Yeah, oh yes, the Skynet or whatever that thing is.
Yeah.
So
fire today.
So yeah, Bill, I don't know. I mean, I think you and I might have approached this particular campfire with a similar amount of wariness. I'd heard some of the stuff that Rebecca's referring to, and I was thinking, is this going to be a big, heavy lift? And it's not at all. I mean, it's like what Sean was saying. It's the scientific stuff is just done in a pretty entertaining and accessible way. I mean, it helps if you know what quantum entanglement is and stuff like that, but it's not even that big a deal. I don't know. I'm finding it a very enjoyable series. I don't know that I feel like it's this transformational look at reality or something, but it's fun and horrific to watch in a fairly engaging way. But how's it looking out in Chicago?
Well, my other degree is in quantum entanglement. Right. So I won't get too much into that. No, Colin, you and I both approach this as innocence abroad. Maybe the only time that you and I are the innocents on the program. Because I haven't read the book, although true confession, you know, there's a part of the show where the universe starts winking at them. Mm-hmm. The book has been sitting in my house winking at me for a long time. As my wife knows, I don't have a three-body problem. I have a 3,000-book problem because there's 3,000 books just in my dining room that I can't wait to get to. This has been one of them, but it allowed me to enter it without, you know, the quantum entanglements of having read the book and either being happy about the adaptation or disappointed by it. I really am into it. When McNichol first came to me about doing this, you know, I had to tell him I'm at this conference. I may only be able to watch three or four episodes. No, I watched it all. Because it grabbed me, it hooked me, I kind of devoured it. I find it to be a great story. It's kind of complex, but it's not too complex. I agree with you that they do the science stuff really well. That does require a little bit of exposition, but that never bothered me. And what I'm really, really into with it is the larger, you know, kind of social, political, cultural allegory of it, where I kind of feel it's very explicitly about when people turn to authoritarian solutions when faced with intractable problems and faced with existential fears. And both this mysterious government organization, which British TV always seems to have a mysterious government organization, both they and the Santi are both offering ultimately authoritarian cult-like solutions. Only I can fix it. We're familiar with that. And that's what both of them are offering to people. And I love the exploration of that.
Yeah. So, by the way, this has some carryover people from Game of Thrones, the authoritarian who was just being mentioned by Bill is played by Liam Cunningham. He was Sir Davos, and now he's Thomas Wade. This kind of mysteriously ruthless, I guess, sort of rich, but also non-specifically incredibly powerful person. Hard to exactly know what that's all about. Maybe we'll know more. I finished six episodes, and I deliberately didn't watch the last two so I could ward off spoilers here. But also Jack Rooney, who was the beloved Sam on Game of Thrones, is in this as well. I don't know if you count Jonathan Pryce as somebody from Game of Thrones because he's kind of everywhere, but he's in this too. So, and you know, Rebecca, it might be interesting to talk about some of the performances, and you know, I know you have some very specific thoughts, and I want to get to those, but I'd like to start with Eliza Gonzalez. She's one of the Oxford Five. Augie Salazar, she's the one who actually did the technology for the Cast-O-Matic egg slicer that you're now selling on QVC. But first of all, I don't know when I've seen a more beautiful woman in my life. I mean, she is literally distractingly beautiful.
Yes.
But once you get past that, I'm wondering what this character does besides invent one thing and then kind of mope. This is apparently one character for the books has been split into three different characters on this series, and she is one of those characters. But I'm kind of wondering what the purpose of this character is, and it's not clear to me right now.
Yeah, so I went through a journey with this. The first episode, my first reaction like yours was like, this woman is distractingly beautiful. Like, I can't, she's like the sun. Like, talk about a three bratty problem. Like, I couldn't stop looking at her, and I was not paying attention to what was going on. And I said, man, this is kind of a choice. And then I was like, you know what? Women in STEM, like, why can't we have hot women in STEM? Like, that's I'm a bad feminist. We should support hotties that are doing intense science nerdy stuff. So I got over that. And then by episode two, I was like, man, she is really not doing much. This is the same facial expression. She's kind of pops up to have a very poetic tear in her eye and then disappears again. And as I said at the top of the episode, I think the choice to split the character of Wang into multiple characters was smart because it allowed, he sort of was an everyman and doing the most in the book. And it almost became a little unbelievable at certain points. And so I thought that really made a lot of sense, but I'm not exactly sure why we needed Augie. Like, I think Jack and Jin would have been enough. And I think Jess Hong, who plays Jin, does a fantastic job with that character. And if she had been the one that did the nanotechnology, that would have been enough and would have been fine. And I don't know if Eliza Gonzalez's casting was a little bit of a stunt cast, because she is definitely one of the more notable names in the cast, short of the Game of Thrones returnees, which people will recognize, and obviously Jonathan Pryce, who's everywhere and is amazing. But she's definitely got a draw. But I've been underwhelmed by her performance. I can't really decide if it's her acting that's not great or the writing of the character was just kind of flat and she's doing what she can with it. I think the jury's still out with me on that. But she's the weak spot for me. I think the rest of the cast is sensational. Benedict Wong is amazing. He really he's so good. Dashi is one of my favorite characters in the book. And I was really pleased when I found out that he was the one taking that on, because he is that bright spot in what can be like a very bleak existential journey. He's very funny. What he's done with that character, he's brought his own sort of spin on it, which I think has been very successful. But yeah, Eliza Gonzalez, beautiful to look at. I'm just really struggling with both the acting and the kind of portrayal of that character. And I almost wish that they hadn't bothered and kept their other, they made it an Oxford Four, perhaps. Mm. But
Well, yeah. it does get to be.
Spoiler.
We should say Benedict Wong plays kind of this noir detective, you know, this kind of rundown British detective who happens to wind up in this kind of, you know, multidimensional sci-fi saga instead of just trying to solve one murder or something like that. Sean,
he's
joining the
Slow Horses group next.
That would totally work
right in there.
That would
That's the same multiverse for sure.
Would be a seamless transition. I don't know, Sean. Does anything about the performances, about the acting, jump out at you?
I'm just kind of confused by you guys saying you don't know what. Aiza Gonzalez was bringing to the series. I mean, they had a mope budget that they had to fulfill. Like, that money goes to waste if she doesn't mope that much. So we had to make sure. No, it's
smoking.
Egregious. Yeah, it's egregious. It's just like, how many times can this lady like tear up because there's numbers in front of her face? Like, I understand if I was in that situation, I'd probably be doing that too. But like, it's like enough. I don't know. Like, yeah, she kind of serves. Like, there's a scene. I believe it's episode 3, and when like she finds out that they've been playing this video game, she's like, "How could you play a video game?" And they're like, "What do you mean?" And he's like, "After your friend died, you're gonna play a video game?" And it's like, "What are you talking about? Like, what is that? Like, how does that mean? I can't do that. Like, I don't know. I don't know." She's not really bringing much to the proceedings. And I do think, like you said, like Rebecca said, Dashi in the book is one of my favorite characters in any book ever. He's so good. And Benedict Wong brings so much to that character that is on the page. And also, obviously, he's just a tremendous actor. So he brings something there, too. I just feel like, back to the actual first question Colin asked me that I completely ignored about the Chinese, sort of taking it from a Chinese specific story to something. I think that's something that gets lost with the Oxford 5 or 4 later on, is that like this is such a these books are such so specifically Chinese stories in the sense of what Bill was saying about how like it's about like latching onto authoritarianism, and it's like it's so built based in the Cultural Revolution that I think some of that is lost when it's just like this sort of blank global look at that. And I think that's some of what I don't like about the Oxford 5. I think I like all of those actors in other stuff individually, but I feel like what they're like, trying to make it like, you know, British or Americanized in how they like talk and behave. It's like, I don't care about like, I don't know, but I will say this. We're talking about, you know, the universe blanking, winking at you and saying like, oh, that's impossible. I guess these people have never done psychedelics because it's you know, it's winked at. A lot of people would say they see it in wink. I don't know that. You guys take it over.
Well,
I've been rambling.
I just also do want to say, in terms of, so several characters, including Eliza Gonzalez's character, Augie, do have this phenomenon that's been foisted upon them where there's this digital clock that's just sizzling in their field of vision, counting hours, minutes, and seconds. Can I just say, that's like my life. I'm sitting here right now looking at a digital clock, counting hours, minutes, and seconds. Suck it up, people. This is what it's like working.
Yeah, you're not crying. You're not over there crying.
Bill, you know, I think you made a really great point about seeking I can't say that word today for some reason. Authoritarian solutions. And some of the mega questions in this, I think, are interestingly posed. And I'm going to try to avoid doing a spoiler here, but it does feel one of the things that I was sort of grinning ruefully at is the idea that, you know, we can't get our act together as a species right now to do anything about climate change. But this is suggesting that if we thought people were 400 or beings were 400 years away from attacking us, we just go totally Armageddon, call Bruce Willis, let's, you know, get some. I mean, and that's probably kind of true, right? A problem that we could solve with some version of violence against somebody else is probably more attractive to us than we have met the enemy and he is us.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most fascinating aspects of the show, that it's not an imminent alien invasion, that, you know, as you say, it is literally centuries away. And what that does in terms of existential dread, I think becomes really, really interesting. It becomes more dread for the species than it is individual dread. It, you know, 400 years, it's not even dread for your ancestors, really, because by the time you get that far out, you know, I can't do the math. Great, 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 great. You know, I'm not sure. So that's fascinating. And and then the aspect of it where not all of us are going to be on the same side if we find out something like that has happened, and who are the real traitors? You know, another, you know, there's the slow horses connection with Jonathan Pryce. And I find his character fascinating, and there's some fascinating scenes where he's communicating with the Santee, and how he has embraced them as literally in some ways God. There's so many religious questions related to this as well. You know, Sodom and Gomorrah, do we need to be wiped out because of our sins? I think all of that is operating on some really fascinating levels that pose these great questions without becoming didactic or too ponderous. And you know, it's there's some questions of there's some critique of utilitarianism in here as well. And yet, as abstract and theoretical as all that might sound, the way it's been put together, I think it's still very entertaining, and you really get into the characters and their relationships.
You know, that whole thing about communicating with them, Rebecca, there are some plot hole problems or plot point problems that I had, and I worry that maybe I just didn't get something. Although,
me too.
You know, there was this whole idea that they seem to know at a certain point, the Santee, who are so far away, they seem to know quite a bit of about us, and they you know, they've got technology that can help them do that. And then there's this thing that I thought was sort of literarily brilliant, Rebecca, but also completely implausible, which is that they have Jonathan Pryce's reading Little Red Riding Hood to them, and they're going, you know, we don't like this. We think we don't like you. And I'm just stealing again from the guys on the watch. They said, have they ever watched any of the Real Housewives shows? This is their key. This fairy tale is the key that we are lying sacks of poop. No, I mean, and that's an interesting point. I mean, I loved it as a literary device, Rebecca, but I didn't think it was particularly, it didn't really make sense in terms of the larger narrative.
Yeah, I think once you have the whole conceit of a sophon introduced, which is just basically like a literal God particle, like you can see and take in everything and manipulate our reality and consciousness, that sort of undermines that scene in a pretty big way. But I don't really care, yes, because that was such an important moment for us understanding their motivations and how they're innocent of human ways, but they need to know, and then they're skeptical, and it under like, did they ever actually trust him, Mike Evans, or were they, you know, it just, I think it worked and was important, even though it kind of does become a plot hole, and I'm okay with that. I think that we all know this is a story. We all know that it's got these allegorical elements to it. So as much as I too was conscious of that, I've just decided I don't care, and I wouldn't have wanted them to cut that scene to repair that plot hole.
Right. So I have to bring up one other plot hole that's really bothering me, and then we got to go to a break so we can give Rami a little bit of our time. But and anybody who can help me out with this can just jump in. But so there's this point. It's in episode 5. I rewatched part of episode 5 to make sure I was
so good
right about this. But so at one point, this ruthless guy Wade, who is kind of orchestrating this, you know, kind of uber national effort to fight off this invasion or whatever, he's talking to Benedict Wong, and he's there's this thing, they need some information, and it's on this boat, and they're talking about how they're going to get this information, this stuff that's on the boat, and they're going, well, we could send in special forces, but that'd be kind of bloody, you know, and we could try to put some gas in there. No, that wouldn't be right either. And then they wind up doing one of the most horrific scenes of carnage that I have ever seen in anything that involves children, you know. And I was thinking, that was their solution? First of all, their solution seems like it would damage the thing that they were trying to get. But it was like, well, we can't do this other stuff because it might be bloody. I don't understand that one.
They actually do explain that in the book a little bit better, that this is kind of a spoiler, but the thing Colin's referring to is basically chopping up a boat into slices. Mm-hmm. And in the book, they make it pretty clear that the reason why they take that approach is because it won't obliterate the computer systems they're looking for. And if it cuts the computer, they can stitch it back together, even if it's in slices, versus if they were to go and blow the ship up, they're going to blow up the intel they want to.
Put a little sarin in there or something.
I agree. I think it's unnecessary, but you know, we've got to like have that circle back moment to the nano threads.
There has to be some reason Augie's in this thing. All right. Correct. We have to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about Rami Youssef, but this is Three Body Problem. I think we all recommend that you watch it, unless you have delicate sensibilities.
Swinging in the backyard, pull up in your fast car, whistling my name. Open up a beer and you say get over here and play a video game.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford Healthcare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford Healthcare. ECMO is a leading-edge, life-saving treatment for patients with cardiac or respiratory failure. Dr. Jason Gluck, director of the Mechanical Circulatory Support Program and Emergency Cardiac Care at Hartford Hospital, explains what it is.
So ECMO stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, outside the body oxygenation of blood. It's a life support technique that's used by highly sophisticated medical systems for patients with severe heart or lung failure. The technique involves removing blood from the body, oxygenating it, and then returning it back.
ECMO procedures happen in the ICU, but not all hospitals are equipped with the necessary technology and staff. Dr. Gluck describes Hartford Hospital's ECMO Go team.
So ECMO is considered when treatments have failed, and in our center, with a special ECMO on the Go team, we'll actually take that technology to their hospital and help them out there if they need to stabilize the patient and then bring them back to Hartford for recovery.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
All right, we are back with The Nose. The Nose is Rebecca Castellani, Sean Murray, Bill Usman. This week, we're going to talk about More Feelings, the second HBO comedy special from Rami Youssef. It follows 2019's Feelings. It's directed by Christopher Storer. Let's hear a little clip from this. This is B1 Cat.
October 10th, I get a call from a guy I know. And he goes, "Yo, bro, where are you at with Hamas?" I'm like, "Where am I at? Like, are we f***ing? What's the... Am I a member?" You think any of us like what happened on October 7th? It's awful. We hate seeing people die. It's inhumane. It made me cry. And it always does. It's why we've been talking about Palestine our whole lives. We hate what's happening there. We want justice. We want peace. And we do. So of course I don't like it. Now I gotta prove to you that I'm not violent. Like, you think that's what's in my heart? You know me. You think like I'm like Hamas. Like, bro, I'm a Taliban guy. Like that's a real group. They've been going for 20 years. You know what I'm saying? Like, they're strong. They don't let anybody go to school. Hamas is letting people go to school. I don't like that. I hate school.
So let's go straight to the comedian. Sean, he's walking a tightrope with this material. I'm wondering what you think of the job he's doing.
I love that. That was my favorite joke in the whole... specifically because he's walking that tightrope of especially right now, it's still a very contentious issue, what's happening in Gaza. But beyond that, just at the time he recorded it, it was specifically, but like to walk that tightrope, and then the misdirect is so strong that it's like you almost have to you can't help but laugh. It's very well done. And I think he does a really good job. That's all my favorite stuff in that special is the stuff that it's talking about Palestine, talking about Saudi Arabia, all that stuff with a sort of mischievous and like winking attitude where it's like, I'm going to be irreverent about this while still being respectful of the issue. Do you know what I mean? And I think that's where it's strongest. I really liked it. I think it felt very accomplished. Like you can't, a less skilled comedian would have fumbled trying to do the exact same thing. I really liked that he was like willing to go there with it and not like sort of shy away from it. Like, and even like just referencing Hamas or Gaza specifically and not just saying what's going on over there in the Middle East, you know what I mean? Like, which a lot of comedians would do, which I understand why they do that, but it's like, he's like, I think he recognizes that he has an audience that would walk that tightrope with him, but also it's still a pretty bold move on, in my estimation, to go there.
Yeah, you know, Bill, the word that I used to my partner at the end of the special is there's something very disarming about this guy. He's just maybe disarming in a bunch of different meanings of that word, but I wouldn't say that I was doubled over with laughter very much or at all. I laughed from time to time, but mostly he was kind of good company. I was sort of enjoying just being with this person who's maybe struggling with some things a lot of us struggle with.
Yeah, he's just a low-key kind of guy. He appears very innocent in some ways. And the way it's filmed, they really develop that. There's a lot of really, really tight close-ups of his face with almost like a bewildered expression on it. At times, I thought they went too far. There was too much of it was very, very tight on his face. I have to say, I didn't love it. I felt a little underwhelmed by it. And maybe my expectations were too high because I am a fan of some other stuff that Rami Youssef has done. You'll hear later on. And it just felt maybe not fully developed to me, maybe not quite yet at the stage where it was ready to be a filmed special, because I feel like there's lots of little threads that he goes down that I wanted him to develop more, and he never really fully stitches them together. Although there were some really great moments. I mean, we heard one in the opening there, and he's trying something really difficult, which is, you know, how can you deal with the misery of Gaza in the current moment? I'm someone who thinks that you can joke about anything, but can you really successfully do that in the midst of it, this close to it? It's ongoing while we're watching him. Not in terms of like avoiding taboos, but in terms of, I'm not sure how much he's able to successfully pull that off. And he seems to me kind of burdened by it. Now that can make it really interesting, but I'm not sure how effective it is as stand-up.
Yeah. You know, to the point that Bill's making, Rebecca, you and I both, I think, laughed at a sequence, a set of riffs involving Jamal Khashoggi. And I was so shocked at myself. I rewound it to see, could I have possibly been, I mean, this is not funny.
Yeah.
You know, could I possibly have been laughing at this? How did he do that? Maybe say something about that. But also, Rebecca, I don't watch comedy specials for the cinematography, but I think you did a little bit here, had some things to say about that as well. So maybe go both those places.
Yeah, I'll start by saying that I really struggle with stand-up streamer productions in general. I find that I never laugh. I find that they're often on these really big stages and you're watching like their most rabid fans have this really overblown reaction. They're laughing a little too eagerly and it just has this like inauthenticity to it. I can't help but think like this performer knows that they're performing in front of people, but also the Netflix cameras or the HBO cameras. And it just kind of ruins it for me. I much prefer to see stand-up in person. And what I loved about this was that it felt really raw and relaxed and intimate, like we were all sitting in the audience with him. I liked those close, tight shots of him. I liked that the colors were all really cool. And the lighting was, there was kind of this one large spotlight on him that it sometimes sort of took almost like a Trisolaris situation, eclipsed him. And that really worked for me. And it actually allowed me to relax as a viewer and laugh more than I probably would have if this was on a much larger scale. I'm thinking about John Mulaney's most recent special, which I know there were funny beats in it, but I did not laugh once during that. And I think it was just because it felt so grandiose that I just couldn't get into it. Whereas this had me laughing at things like you, Colin, that really surprised me, like that I had that sort of self-reflexive, like, should I be laughing at this? Am I just a terrible person? But the way he handled it and the way he was able to inject that bait and switch levity into some really, really dark social critique was masterful. And I think it was just so different from a lot of these comedy specials. And if more were filmed in that sort of intimate, up close and personal way, I think I'd prefer the genre. And I think the things that Bill, maybe you identified as feeling a little unfinished, I liked that. I think it, again, feels more natural and like I'm watching a performer work something out on stage. And maybe that was an intentional choice, as they chose a performance where it wasn't complete and it wasn't like he had every beat down. His cadence, I think, also lends itself well to that. He'll wait a little too long for the punchline or even the next part of the joke. So much so that a couple times I'm like, did he forget his train of thought?
Yeah,
like,
I had that exact reaction. Although I want to quickly, first of all, give you an award for the Papoulian through line that you did there, connecting the suns in Three Body Problem to the light in the Rami Yusuf special. That was very impressive. But, you know, Sean, we're kind of out of time here, but I think this is a point worth making and making with a comedian. What Rebecca's saying, it struck me that he was almost a little slow in a way that may have hampered him. That kind of low energy slowness certainly was some of the callbacks. Like, you know, there's a callback at one point where I don't know about you, I'm a comedy nerd, you're a comedian, but I was just looking at my watch going, okay, get to it. You're going to say, he doesn't know how to read either. I know you're getting there. Come on, Robbie. Mm-hmm. And Sean, that's a bad feeling if you feel like you know what's coming and you're right.
Absolutely. I just want to say, I just had to take a few deep breaths because I was just seething with rage when Rebecca said she didn't like Baby J.
But I'm back.
Me too.
I've centered myself.
I'm canceled. It's okay. Yeah. The first time on the show.
But no, I agree. I think it's again, like I was saying, like he's an accomplished comedian. So there's a comfortability you get on stage where you're like, when you're a younger comedian, like, you know, you don't have as much stage experience, like you're nervous. And whenever it's silent, you are freaking out in your head. When you get to a certain point on stage, that you get to a certain point in your career, you're like, I control the silence. You know what I mean? Like, they are waiting on my every word. So it's not like I'm not fearful. I'm like, I'm able to manipulate this. And I think there's almost too much comfortability. This special kind of reminded me, I like this one a little better, but of Gerard Carmichael's last two specials, where he just keeps going more and more intimate with it. And it's like, I appreciate the intimacy of it. But it's almost like I'm torn because, like, to Rebecca's point, I do appreciate the intimacy of it, but I also watch enough live comedy that I see that, like, for a special, I want it to be a production because this is for TV. It's not for like, you know, this is being produced as a special. Like, what makes this special? You know what I mean? And that's like, sometimes it is that grandiosity, and sometimes there are, you know, particular specials that are very intimate and really well done. I think of like Todd Barry's Spicy Honey that he had on Netflix a few years ago that I really love. But it's a balance. And I feel like it's not like, it's like 70-30 good to not as good. It's never bad, but it's like, I feel like it's just not as strong at certain points because I think some of that burden that Bill talks about in terms of like, I think he does feel the weight of some of the issues. I think he gets a little looser as he goes on with some of that stuff, like the Olive Garden and all that stuff, because it's less about like the moment and less about like what is happening in the world and more about like, I'm a goofball, like, you know, and like, you know, I'm ridiculous. My dad thinks I'm ridiculous. All that stuff kind of works a little bit stronger. But I think generally I like a big production if the comedy meets it. You know what I mean? Like it can't be a big extravaganza and then also not good jokes.
Totally get it. Hey, we got to take a break here in order for you to have some time to recommend stuff. So let's do that. We'll be right back. Our technical producer today is Kat Pastor. The episode producer is Jonathan McPants. We're going to make some recommendations to you right now. We've got about 5 minutes left here. Rebecca Castellani, what have you got for us?
All right. I'll just go with one to keep it short. So I'm going to preface this by saying I know absolutely nothing about ice skating, so keep that in mind. But on Saturday, 19-year-old Ilya Malinin, a.k.a. the Quad God, broke the men's free skate record with a bunch of sick quads. But more importantly, his routine was to a remix of the Succession soundtrack, which anyone that listens to the show knows how obsessed I am with the Succession soundtrack. And it is fire, start to finish. The juxtaposition of Nicholas Britell's score and watching this guy do some incredible quads. Again, I don't know anything about skating. I just know that they're called quads, and he did a bunch of them, and it just blew the record out of the water by like 30 points. And if you watch this, it's on YouTube. Make sure you watch the version with the commentators, because they are nerding out and it is just infectious. You can't help but sharing their glee as he lands like his sixth quad, and they're just losing their mind. And it is just one of the most enjoyable 10-minute videos I've ever seen. And the kid's amazing, 19. And he loves the Succession soundtrack. What's not to love?
Wow, that's great. That's going to be great in our newsletter tomorrow, too. So, Sean Murray, how about you?
I will second that. I saw that on Twitter. It was amazing. I don't even watch figure skating. I don't care about it at all. It was impressive. He was flexing out there. I would also like to say, Rebecca, don't be modest. You know, you should have endorsed your own organization, Hot Women in STEM. I would like to endorse that myself.
She's accepting and, donations right now.
Yes, that's right. Link in bio.
I'm reading right now R.F. Kuang's Babel or Babel.
Yes.
It's a very good speculative fiction novel about 18th or 19th century Oxford. Like, there's a sort of school of translation called Babel, where basically the power of translating languages is like magical, and you can there's like, it's an economy powered by these silver bars that are imbued with magic through translations. Very complicated to explain right now, but it's a very fascinating like critique on imperialism and you know, British society, which I'm always for. And it's, you know, it's just amazing. And also R.F. Kuang's like 27, she's got like eight great books. It's disheartening. And I'm the youngest person on this panel, and I'm still upset about it. So I know how you guys must feel.
I second every word of that.
Right. Bill Usman, live from Chicago. What have you got?
So since we were talking about an adaptation of a complex novel, I think Jonathan Glazer's take on The Zone of Interest might be legitimately considered a masterpiece. But what I want to endorse is Martin Amis's novel from 2014. Mm. They're really very different.
Yeah,
Glazer's film was more inspired by it than anything else. Amis's uses really multiple first-person perspectives in a way that's absolutely chilling and provocative. And then really quickly, I hinted at this, I want to re-endorse, because I think I did it before, Rami Youssef's series, his comedic dramatic television series that was on Hulu for three seasons, just called Rami. It's about religion, relationships, family, bigotry, really, really funny, but also really kind of poignant, multi-layered storytelling. I think it's really fantastic.
All right. I'll try to do some booky stuff myself. Don Winslow, the crime writer, is wrapping up his writing career, according to him. I think he is going to be here in studio with me on Wednesday. But he's wrapping up his career with three crime novels kind of based on Rhode Island gangsters. The first one was based on the Iliad, or loosely modeled on the Iliad. The second one on the Aeneid. And I assume the last one is the Odyssey. I'm going to be reading the last one this week. And I love the first two. He does a lot with some fairly simple language and ideas and characters. Things get very complex. I'm also just wrapping up a much more traditional kind of British procedural novel called Songbird by Peter Granger. I never read any of his work before. I'm really loving this. The last thing I'll say is that the title of the book is based on the Christine McVie Fleetwood Mac song that was also covered by Eva Cassidy. Each of those versions plays something of a role in the plot of the book, which is kind of interesting. And so the last thing I will do is endorse Christine McVie. I couldn't stand Fleetwood Mac once Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks got there, but almost throughout the entire history of Fleetwood Mac, Christine McVie just wrote the most soulful and sang the most soulful stuff. Just Spare Me a Little from Bare Trees is the one I would have you seek out this weekend. Thanks so much to this wonderful panel. This has been The Nose. Sean Murray, Rebecca Castellani, and Bill Usman have all been with us. Get ready. Go online. Order your Castomatic egg slicers. They are flying off the shelves. Get them before the Santi arrive.
it's cold and gray outside, and the streets are filled with snow. When you're drinking lots of coffee, and the words begin to flow. When you're lonely, and you got no place to go. I see you on the radio. Oh yeah, I see you on the radio. I see you on the radio. Let me tell you, baby, I'll meet you down on Asylum, across from St. Francis, past the conservatory, up the street from the seminary. You know, it's a very, very, very cool place to hang out. Yeah.